This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ, Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
With his wild electric eyeballs and his cigarette machine, he could play that old guitar like no man you've ever seen. He was Southern, he was Central, he was easy, he was mean. He was Saratoga Billy, and they called him Billy Dean. He could sound the strings like silver or a dead man in the shade. And it's many a lonesome midnight soul that came to where his songs are played. He was a rambler and a gambler, and you could not tie him down. As well they do remember in that Saratoga town. Well, one fine day a letter came from the army that did say, we'd like to make a man of you in the old American way. So he got all of his things together and he rode off down the track. Oh, but 3 weeks later, Billy Dean was back. He stayed away so very long, in trouble deep he grew. And his friends, they all got nervous, but there was nothing he would do. Until one day they found him, he was playing his guitar. They put the handcuffs on him, they took him away in a government car. While working on the highway on the stockade crew, he saw a car of people that was only passing through. He waved an arm to signal and they stopped to let him in. And when the guard turned his head around, Billy Dean was gone. Well, then the army fathers, well, they all got so mad that Saratoga Billy, who had done bad, they puffed and they sputtered and they almost lost their minds. For in Saratoga country, Billy Dean was hard to find. Well, it's been many years now since I seen him last. And I just ain't got the time, oh, to spend on the past. Yeah, but sometimes I wonder, sometimes I think, that when it's late in the evening, or I've had too much to drink, with his wild electric eyeballs and his cigarette machine, he could play that old guitar like no man you ever seen. He was Southern, he was Central, he was easy, he was mean. He was Saratoga Billy, and they called him Billy Dean. He was Saratoga Billy, and they called him Billy Dean.
Jim Page singing Saratoga Billy. The experiences of the Vietnam War era informed the work of our next speaker, Anthony Arnove. Arnove is an author, editor, and activist who has been on tour discussing his recent book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal.
Thanks, and thanks to everyone for coming out. One of the things I've been trying to do in my book and through going around and speaking about it has been to give a voice to those veterans of this conflict who are speaking out, who are describing the reality of what's happening in Iraq under occupation. So I want to talk a little bit about the genesis of this book, and then a little bit about the situation in Iraq today and the argument that I'm trying to lay out in it. The title of my book is stolen from a book by Howard Zinn. I wish I didn't have to take the title, but Howard wrote a book during the Vietnam War called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. People may remember it was published in 1967 by Beacon Press, little thin pamphlet, yellow, quickly went through a number of printings and reprintings. And a couple years ago, I was working in a publishing house in Boston called South End Press, and I realized the book had gone out of print. This was in about 2001. And so I republished the book with a short little preface by Howard Zinn, and at the same time published some other books by Howard that had gone out of print. And at the time, I reread Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal, and I was struck by how powerful his arguments were then. In 1967, he laid out a very clear, concise case that the only solution in Vietnam was immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops. And he said that the war was unwinnable from the standpoint of U.S. empire. But more than that, that it was fundamentally immoral and wrong. The U.S. had no right to be in Vietnam and had to go. And you realize that Howard was arguing not so much with people in Washington, but he was arguing with other people in the movement, people who, particularly liberals, who felt like, okay, maybe things are going badly in Vietnam, maybe we shouldn't have gotten involved, but now that we're there, can we somehow turn this into something better? We have an obligation to the Vietnamese people. We can't pull out. There'll be chaos. All of the arguments that are coming up now with regard to Iraq. And when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, I found history repeating itself in so many ways, and so many of the arguments Howard was laying out in that book being so relevant to our situation. And that sense of history that Howard Zinn always brings to his projects is so important because certainly in our schools and certainly in the establishment media, the history of U.S. imperial interventions, the history of our meddling in other countries' affairs is erased. We're given this completely sanitized version of our history in which the United States does nothing but act benevolently towards other countries with no interests of its own, just to help them, you know, like a Boy Scout helping an old lady cross the street. That's what U.S. foreign policy is. But of course, it's quite different. So about 2 years ago, I said to a publishing friend of mine that really the New Press, which is the publisher who I ultimately did this book with, ought to find someone to do a modern edition of this book. And I was hoping someone else might do it, but in the end, the New Press convinced me to do it, for better or worse. And about a year ago, I really felt a tremendous sense of urgency at putting out this argument, because so many people I knew marched on February 15th, 2003, who had been out on the streets, who had opposed the invasion before it began, felt like once we were in Iraq, we couldn't pull out. The United States had to stay. The occupation somehow could go from being something that was so destructive to being somehow something that would rebuild Iraq, bring democracy, prevent civil war from breaking out, and a whole series of other ideas that began to circulate that led people to have a reluctance to call for immediate withdrawal of troops. And so what I try to do in the book is a couple of things. One, to present a picture of what life under occupation is really like, a picture that we don't get in the mainstream media today, and then to lay out an argument based on history and based on what's happening in Iraq today of why immediate withdrawal is the only viable solution, and then to lay out a bit of a strategy for how a movement can achieve immediate withdrawal. And we're now 3 years into this occupation of Iraq, and I think a couple of things have become really clear and bear repeating an emphasis. The first is that on every single point, the anti-war movement was right about Iraq. We were right, and the pundits were wrong, the politicians were wrong, the establishment press was wrong. They peddled a whole series of lies, and we know what they all are now, about weapons of mass destruction, about the imminent threat that Iraq posed to the United States, about the connections between Iraq and September 11th, between Iraq and al-Qaeda, repeated over and over and over again, the biological and chemical weapons lab, the slam dunk case, and then a whole series of lies about what occupation would look like, that the Iraqi people would greet U.S. soldiers with sweets and flowers. That's what they said, that you wouldn't need a lot of troops because it's not going to be a long occupation. The Iraqis are going to welcome U.S. soldiers. They're going to change sides and fight alongside them. The occupation will pay for itself, and the troops will be home very quickly. You know, and May 1, which we're just past the third anniversary of, we all remember George Bush's military moment off the coastline of San Diego, mission accomplished. What a lot of people don't know is that shot of him landing on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln had to be staged a couple of different times, because when they first were doing it, they realized that the San Diego coastline, which he was only, you know, right off of, was in the shot, and that wouldn't look proper enough. So they had to turn around the boat so that the photo and the plane landing would have him look like he was at sea. So they had that moment. The troops are going to come home. Mission accomplished. But the anti-war movement said all along that the claims about weapons of mass destruction were not credible, that the claims about al-Qaeda and the threat that Iraq posed were not credible, and that the Iraqi people, who have a long history of resisting foreign occupation, would not sit idly by and accept a foreign occupation. And we were absolutely right. And the lies ultimately unraveled. Even the New York Times, Washington Post, the mainstream papers that had been front-paging the claims of the government, which had been using those papers as a propaganda mechanism for selling the war to a skeptical public, and that those newspapers had gone along for the ride quite willingly, they ultimately had to have a reckoning where, you know, it wasn't on page A1 where the lies had been, but, you know, on page A18 you could read, maybe we were a little too credulous towards government sources who were giving information that we should have been more skeptical about. But then those same journalists, those same media outlets today are going back to those same people who lied to them about the reasons for going into Iraq, about why the U.S. can't leave Iraq today. And a whole series of new lies have been developed. The first lies were the lies needed to get us into Iraq. Now they have the lies designed to keep us in Iraq. And those lies are pretty familiar to people by now, I imagine. That the United States is in Iraq to bring democracy. That the United States is in Iraq to prevent civil war from breaking out. That the United States is confronting the terrorists in Iraq rather than confronting them here in the streets of the United States. Those arguments repeated on a daily basis. And really, you have to begin to question what's at stake for them. What is the motivation? And the motivation is, as the anti-war movement said from the outset, oil. Control and domination of Iraqi oil, and through control and domination of Iraqi oil, domination of Middle Eastern energy resources more broadly. Iraq has the world's second largest oil reserves, but it sits in a region with two-thirds of world oil reserves. Also, it sits in a region with the vast majority of the world's natural gas reserves. And as short-sighted and as oil-dependent as the U.S. economy and U.S. military are, they do know that oil is getting harder and harder to extract, that it's becoming more expensive to extract, that the quality of the crude is declining, and they're having to go to more environmentally and geographically and politically unstable and difficult locations in order to extract that oil. And therefore, Iraqi oil, which is some of the easiest and cheapest and most profitable to extract, very high-quality crude, has a tremendous advantage. But also, they're looking down the line to their need to dominate natural gas resources as well, not just oil resources. And they understand something else, which is very important, which is that the United States wants to preserve. They're very open about this. If you read the Quadrennial Defense Review that just came out, or you read the National Security Strategy document, which was published in September 2002, which laid out the argument for and the rationale for preemptive strikes against Iraq. The United States wants to preserve its status as the sole superpower in the world. They don't want to have any economic, political, or military competitor that can rival their power and their ability to intervene in other countries' affairs, to dominate other countries' economies, as well as their politics. And they look down the line and they see China emerging. They see India emerging. They see a number of countries who, with rapidly growing economies that could potentially down the line emerge as rivals, contenders for regional or even global power. And those countries that they look at have some interesting qualities to them, one of which is that they're heavily dependent on energy imports, in particular imports from the Middle East. China, Japan, India import far, far more of their energy reserves and resources from the Middle East than does the United States. And so it becomes a lever, it becomes a tool, a mechanism of control. And the United States has long had this objective, but September 11th provided a pretext. It provided a way of describing a whole series of offensive goals that the United States had in defensive terms, rather than defining it as conquering, asserting hegemony, taking control of energy resources. They defined it as defending our national interests, protecting us from terrorists, stopping attacks. So they could try to sell this to a skeptical public. And for a brief period, because of all the lies about Al-Qaeda and 9/11, they were able to get public support behind them. But then it's completely unraveled in Iraq. All of their rhetoric about what they would achieve in Iraq has blown up in their face. And remember, it wasn't just in Iraq, they said, that the occupation would lead to this glorious transformation. They said throughout the entire Middle East there would be a wave of democratization set off by the occupation of Iraq. So the situation has blown up in their face, but because of how much is at stake for them, they're not going to just sit by idly. It's not just what's at stake in terms of the material interest, but it's also what's at stake in terms of the legitimacy of U.S. empire. If they made all these claims about their power and what they would achieve in Iraq, and they're defeated in Iraq, they see that it would threaten their ability to then project their power around the world. In Latin America, where they're concerned about energy nationalizations, in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Asia, in other countries in the world. And they're trying to diversify their energy resources right now, Right now, the U.S. gets as much of its energy from Africa as it does from the Middle East. Why do you think all of a sudden there's this new interest in Africa? You know, it's not because of AIDS. It's not because of poverty. It's not because they care about debt or short lifespans in Africa. It's because they see that Western Africa is emerging as an important base for energy resources, and they want to dominate them. Why do you think they were interested in the overthrow of Hugo Chavez? They still are, but to the point of involvement in a coup attempt a few years ago. So they're looking to diversify. They want to dominate the Middle East, but it's not only the Middle East. They need to remain a hegemonic power in Latin America, in Asia, and ultimately globally. So the situation is going very badly for them. Public opinion has turned against the war. The soldiers, the poll of soldiers is tremendously significant, 72% wanting to come home. In this country, now a majority wanting withdrawal. And Bush's popularity rating is now the lowest of any president since Nixon during the Watergate crisis. And you look at the polls about people's opinions about his handling of foreign policy or Congress's handling of foreign policy, and they're through the floor as well. So they're now find themselves in a situation where the war is unpopular. Soldiers are not only showing disaffection with it, but are organizing into groups like of Iraq Veterans Against War. You have Cindy Sheehan and other military families speaking out. And you also have the sharpest decline in recruitment for the U.S. military, the sharpest shortfall in terms of their meeting the goals that they've set for themselves since right after the Vietnam War as well. So they fear, very concretely, their ability to recruit the next layer of people who are going to be sent in to fight the wars that they want to fight. They're cracking down very hard on counter-recruitment activists. Some, you know, in many cases, very small protests, just a handful of people confronting military recruiters about the lies they use to get people into the military, but being met with very harsh repression. And that shows the fear that they have about the impact the counter-recruitment movement is having. There's also been a series of resolutions and propositions that have passed, challenging the right of recruiters to come into public schools. Proposition in San Francisco is a very good example. In Wisconsin, they passed a series of out-now resolutions in 24 towns over the last couple of months. In Seattle, the Parent Teacher Student Association passing a resolution against recruiters coming into the public schools. Very.
City of Santa Monica passed it.
Yep, Santa Monica as well. So there's a number of things emerging that are very threatening to them. And the as I said, public opinion has shifted. So in that situation, I think we also have to be aware, though, that they're not going to just sit idly by and let Iraq blow up completely in their faces. They're looking for alternative scenarios. And those scenarios, I think, we have to contemplate very seriously, are quite serious ones. One scenario that's being talked about very openly and in many ways is already being implemented is the El Salvadorization strategy, arming of Shia death squads, sending more military artillery into Iraq, and engaging in pacification campaigns that will make what we saw in Fallujah look very tame in comparison. The Wall Street Journal had an op-ed a couple of weeks ago by a writer at the American Enterprise Institute who urged pacification campaigns, which a term that people will remember from Vietnam, pacification campaigns targeted at the major urban centers of Iraq, particularly Baghdad, a city of many millions of people. And he said it will lead to skyrocketing body counts and horrific images that will be broadcast around television all around the world. But no matter, that's what we need to do. The Democrats, like Hillary Clinton and Joe Lieberman, calling for more troops to be sent into Iraq. Not a withdrawal, but more troops to be sent. And the Bush administration absolutely escalating the rhetoric about Iran in a way that we have to take very, very seriously. The National Security Strategy document I mentioned earlier from September 2002 which laid out the doctrine of preemptive strike, which set out the framework for the invasion of Iraq. That document mentioned Iran only one time. And the reference in that document was to Iraq's attack on Iran using chemical weapons. Now, they didn't mention in that document that the United States supported Iraq, encouraged it to invade Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, and stood by it when it used chemical weapons, and continued to arm and fund and protect Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government. But that was the context in which Iran came up. This new version of the National Security Strategy, which was published a month ago, and which folks can read on the whitehouse.gov website, has numerous references to Iran as the greatest threat that the United States faces, the greatest foreign policy challenge, a major sponsor of terrorism. The same script that was used to justify the invasion of Iraq now being rolled out to justify an attack on Iran. And you go back to 1967, 1968 in Vietnam, when the United States was being defeated, especially after the Tet Offensive, where militarily it had clearly suffered a major setback. They didn't retreat. They actually expanded the war into Laos, into Cambodia, with tremendously devastating consequences. So there's a tremendous urgency to what we're trying to do to end the occupation of Iraq, not just for the Iraqi people, and there it's absolutely urgent, but also for the world. One of the consequences of this invasion was to have a profoundly destabilizing effect on geopolitics around the world, in the Middle East in particular. But it sent a signal to country after country that Iraq was invaded not because it had weapons of mass destruction, but because it did not have weapons of mass destruction. It did not have a deterrent to U.S. power. It did not have a way of fending off the sole superpower. And of course, that has set off, quite understandably, a global arms race, a global race to develop deterrent to U.S. intervention. And that explains a lot of the skirmishes that we're now seeing emerge in the world. But those skirmishes can very quickly become quite deadly, especially when one considers that the United States is developing a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, including what they call mini-nukes, nukes which are far more devastating and powerful than the nukes dropped on Japan in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But what they're hoping to do is create these nuclear weapons that will somehow change the very high bar that's been set for the use of nuclear weapons to reintroduce the idea of so-called tactical nuclear strikes. But there's no such thing. It would be devastating if any of these weapons were developed. But the U.S. is not only developing them, but setting in motion a series of actions that will lead other countries to try to develop them as well as a deterrent. But the reality is that empires can't always get their way. And in Iraq, we're seeing that very clearly. The United States was defeated in Vietnam, and they may very well be defeated in Iraq. But that's not inevitable. And I think, and in the book, I go through some of the lessons of the Vietnam War, and I'll end on this point. If you go back to the Vietnam War, five kind of currents came together that helped bring about an end to that war. The first was the resistance of the Vietnamese people themselves. Massive opposition, a small peasant army defeating the largest military power in the world because of their political objective, because of how popular and legitimate their resistance was, and they rejected the foreign occupation, and they were willing to fight to an end, to rid themselves of it. Then there was a rebellion within the rank of the U.S. military, and this part of the history is often completely ignored, but it's a central part of what ended the Vietnam War. And if people have a chance later tonight, you have a rare opportunity to see a film called Sir, No Sir. It's just down the block, a film by a local filmmaker named David Zeger that documents the GI rebellion during the Vietnam War and makes connections to what's happening in Iraq today. It's a tremendously powerful film. It corrects so many myths about the Vietnam War, about the relationship between the military movement and the anti-war movement at home. You know, all of these lies about the anti-war movement spitting on soldiers and so on completely debunks it. It shows that soldiers were vital to the anti-war movement, to ending the war. And there's a book, if you get a chance to read it, by David Courtwright called Soldiers in Revolt. It was recently republished by Haymarket Books. Howard Zinn wrote a new introduction, and David Courtwright updates the book. That's a fabulous documentation of that rebellion. Then the third current was the loss of the war at home. You know, Nixon and all those guys and Johnson said that they didn't listen to the protests, but we know they did. We have the declassified documents that show the level of concern, the internal discussion, that they were losing control of the society. And that ultimately, they were so concerned about losing control at home that they had to retreat in order to try to reassert control at home in order to keep the thing together. And two other things came together, which was that the United States grew more and more isolated internationally, and the economic costs of the war mounted to the point where even elites who had defended the war saw that it was hurting the economic and long-term imperial interests of the United States. All of those things are coming together now in Iraq. We can't control all of the economic costs of the war, but we certainly can expose those costs and make connections to local issues where in city after city in this country, people are facing budget cuts, veterans programs are being cut, teacher salaries are being cut, the number of teachers are being cut. There was an article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about cultural programs for deaf children being cut. Yet there's hundreds of billions of dollars for this war. Those kinds of connections we can highlight. And people, I think, are increasingly seeing that this war affects everyone, affects every community, and that the war abroad goes hand in hand with a war at home, a war on poor people, a war on immigrants, a war on also on our civil liberties. But also, we can't control the international isolation of the United States, but we can control a number of things. We certainly can extend solidarity and support to every veterans group, military family group, conscientious objector that's building that very vital seeds of resistance within the ranks of the U.S. military. We can do very important work in that area. And we can also do very important work in counter-recruitment and in organizing opposition at home. The polls show that there's massive disaffection with this war, but there's a gap between the level of disaffection and the level of organization, the level of protest. We can close that gap, I think, and we can take inspiration from the demonstrations that have been happening around this country over the last several weeks, asserting the civil rights of immigrants in this country, that show the power of protest. They've completely changed the nature of the debate around immigration in this country in the last few weeks, and that also show that an important connection has to be drawn between domestic issues and issues of foreign policy. And if you go back to the Vietnam War, one of the decisive elements in sparking the GI rebellion was the civil rights movement at home. People making connections between the racism that they saw in communities around this country and the racism they experienced as soldiers sent in to occupy and dominate another people who they had to dehumanize as gooks and so on, just as soldiers in Iraq today are taught to see Iraqis as hajis and so on. And those connections can be very dynamic and dangerous indeed for the people who are trying to turn this war into something that will give them long-term military bases, long-term control in the Middle East, a stable client regime in Iraq. But the reality is that that goal that they have is completely at odds with what the Iraqi people want. The Iraqi people don't want to live under occupation, and they don't want their oil resources dominated by a foreign power. So it's a completely untenable situation. That contradiction is going to exist as long as the U.S. occupation is there. And so as long as the U.S. occupation is there, it's only going to get worse, and it's only going to lead to greater instability, greater conflict, and greater likelihood of civil war in Iraq, which is why, really, there's a tremendous urgency to ending this occupation. Questions and comments? Yes, sir. The question is about the resistance among U.S. soldiers in Iraq, to what extent it's happening and to what extent it's happening. We don't know about it because the media doesn't want to cover this. There are a number of indications that there's widespread discontent, just to start with. The poll I mentioned showing the 72% that would like to get out of there. But also, if you read some of the websites and blogs and newsletters that have been set up by U.S. veterans of this war occupation and also active duty troops in Iraq, these websites have become the equivalent of the GI newspapers of the Vietnam War. You know, they were distributed underground. Hundreds of these newspapers were set up. Now the internet makes it a little easier to get some of these ideas circulated. There's a email kind of GI rebellion, you know, listserv, which is called GI Special. And if you get a chance to look at it, I recommend it. You'll see a tremendous amount of disaffection and people beginning to speak out and begin to organize as soldiers against the war. Now, in terms of refusing orders, which is really where things begin to get serious, and which happened on a widespread basis in Vietnam, you've had a couple of instances of soldiers refusing to go out on missions that they considered suicidal missions. So the most famous case was the 138th Quartermaster Division from Kentucky, where they refused to go out on a mission as a group, which is very important. It wasn't just one individual, as a group. And they were severely punished, but they took that stance. And I think that was a good, it was an inspiring example. Another thing that's been going on that I think could spill over into a more serious opposition is that a number of soldiers have been buying their own body armor or having it sent to them by their families. But the U.S. military just said to these soldiers, to these troops, you can't wear that body armor because it's not Army regulation. Now, can you imagine? First of all, you were told this is going to be a quick occupation. You're not going to be there very long. The Iraqi people are going to greet you with sweets and flowers. That's what they were told. You get there, they hate you, they're resisting, they're very intelligent resistance, and people are dying every day, and then you can't have proper body armor because it's not Army regulation. Soldiers, you know, are only going to take that so long. And so a lot of people who have come back have refused to go back for another tour of duty. There's widespread desertion, which has been underreported. That's been significantly underreported. But unfortunately, it also takes other forms. Last year, more U.S. soldiers committed suicide than any year since 1993. So it can turn inward. It doesn't necessarily turn outward in the if there's not political organization. Now, one very other encouraging development, I think, is the immigrants' rights demonstrations that have been occurring around this country. Not only are they important in their own right, but if you go back to the Vietnam War, it was the civil rights demonstrations in this country that helped inspire the rebellion in Vietnam. And I think these demonstrations can have a similar effect, particularly when you consider how many people in the military are people who are there hoping that they might have better access to getting citizenship, providing for their family, and so on. And they see the racism of this occupation just like they saw the racism in Vietnam. There it was gooks, here it's Hajis and Rugheads. So I hope people will begin making those connections. In the back? The question is about Iran and the plans for a possible attack on Iran and how that would also affect the situation in Iraq. First of all, just quickly about the title, The Logic of Withdrawal. The logic is not, I don't think that people in Washington are going to see the logic. So it's not about them seeing it because their priorities are completely illogical and opposed to logic. But I'm hoping that enough ordinary people will see the logic of withdrawal that we'll be able to compel them to have to withdraw, whether or not they see the logic or not. What they're now talking about doing in Iran is completely illogical as well, and irrational and tremendously destructive and horrible to contemplate. Iran is three times the size of Iraq. It has a much stronger military than Iraq has, and that for 12 years, Iraq had been subjected to not only sanctions, but bombing that had completely destroyed its infrastructure before the United States went in. I mean, the idea that Iraq was the threat to the United States, and also that we didn't know that there were weapons of mass destruction while we had drones going over every inch of the country, mapping it all out, And they knew they had taken photographs of everything in Iraq, but then they were surprised when they didn't find weapons of mass destruction. But that's to the side. The plans for Iran, what's interesting about them, first of all, is that they've been leaked partly by generals and top military officials who are disaffected with the way the war is going in Iraq. And you see some cracks emerging. This has something to do with some of the general, retired generals who are criticizing Rumsfeld. And I think that there are some people in the military who are worried about the seriousness of these plans, these kind of war game scenarios for Iran. And they're worried that the U.S. military is overstretched, couldn't actually take on an intervention in Iran. And I think, realistically speaking, I think a ground invasion of Iran would be suicidal for the United States to contemplate in terms of the number of troops and resources it would take at the same time as they've been bogged down in Iraq. So we partly have the Iraqis to thank for the fact that Syria and Iran have not yet been invaded. That was the rhetoric right after, you know, the fall of Baghdad was, okay, now we march on to Syria, to Damascus, and to Tehran. So I think the far more likely scenario, and one that could happen in the near future, would be a tactical strike on an alleged nuclear facility in Iran. That could be the United States that would conduct that strike, or it could be Israel, at the behest of the United States, conduct that strike. With the calculation that if Iran were to respond to that attack, it would lead to a kind of mutual assured destruction situation. So Iran couldn't respond. I think that that is a very risky proposition indeed. And I think given how much anger and resentment there is at the United States and the world, if tomorrow morning we wake up and we read in the papers that there's been a tactical strike in Iran, you're going to have every embassy, U.S. embassy around the world, a target of major demonstrations, and who knows what that's going to lead to. And it could lead to a serious military conflict between the United States and Iran, and that is also just devastating to consider. And I think these people would do it. I mean, they're willing to take us to the brink of nuclear self-annihilation, which is, again, all the more reason that there's so much urgency to creating in Iraq what we created in Vietnam, the Vietnam Syndrome, a defeat for the United States that hindered their ability to project their power into other countries. Maybe over here. It's a two-part question. The first part is about whether or not the United States is encouraging civil war in Iraq and might benefit from civil war in Iraq. And the second is about whether or not they might be anticipating a response to a tactical strike in Iran that would lead to a situation where there were attacks on the United States, an escalation of the war on terrorism, and that would lead to a rallying effect behind the president and so on, and give them a new kind of lease on life. To the first part of the question about civil war, first of all, the United States is absolutely encouraging civil war in Iraq. The United States has stoked divisions between Sunni and Shia, which are not natural divisions in the society. Sunni and Shia intermarry, live together, work together, live in integrated neighborhoods. There's nothing natural about those divisions. And they're also stoking division between Kurd and Muslim, and between Arab and Persian. And even within those groups, there's certain factions that they're manipulating. And it is, as to use the expression used, it's classic colonial divide and rule tactics. But I think you have to step back for a second and first say, what was the ideal scenario? And then what has then happened as a result of not achieving the ideal scenario? Was the ideal scenario to go in and divide up the country and have civil war and chaos? Or was the ideal scenario what they said, which was bring in this exile government, impose it, have it be a loyal client state, maintain the territorial integrity of Iraq, have military bases, and get the oil flowing? I actually think that from the standpoint of U.S. empire, that was a more an optimal solution. Turn Iraq into a client state, a military base, a reliable exporter of oil, an ally of the United States in a hostile part of the world, and to use it to try to then project power against other states like Syria and Iran and so on. So that is based on the idea of of a unified Iraq and a stable government, not on a situation of civil war. When it became clear that that situation was completely unachievable, that they couldn't get that, then I think they set in place a series of decisions that encouraged civil war and where they then sought to manipulate the divisions in the country to their advantage. So we're now in a Plan B situation for them. And in Plan B, there's a bit of a problem, though, because if the country does break up into three factions, and Joe Biden's even recommending this, you know, formally proposing partition, if it does break up, then you have a bit of a problem. One is that you have a large Shia population in the south that's concentrated in the south of Iraq that is very likely to turn against the United States and be aligned with Iran. Then you have a Kurdish population in the north that wants to assert independence, which is something that Iran and Turkey are absolutely against because they have large Kurdish minorities and the United States has long opposed Kurdish independence. And then in the center of the country, you have a completely disenfranchised Sunni population with no oil resources because the oil in Iraq is concentrated in the north and the south. So that creates a very difficult situation for the United States to control. It may ultimately be that they conclude that that's all that they can get out of the situation, but I don't think that that's their ideal scenario. I think their ideal scenario is still somehow to come up with a client state in Iraq and to keep it unified. But the problem, of course, is that any government that's going to be allied with the United States is going to be hated by the domestic population. So it's a profoundly unstable situation. And then just very quickly in terms of Iran, I think that they see Iran as an opportunity to distract attention away from Iraq and as a way of escalating this rhetoric about weapons of mass destruction, the threat of weapons of mass destruction. But I don't think that they've thought through the scenario as far as you suggested. I don't see evidence for that yet. Maybe Sarah? Okay. No, it's a very important question. How can the anti-war movement be more effective? In particular, can it show more solidarity with Iraqis? And how can it relate to the kind of burgeoning immigrants' rights movement that we've seen in the last few weeks and months? And first of all, we have to see, in terms of the immigrant rights movement, that this is a very important and allied cause. I've unfortunately been in a few discussions with anti-war activists who are upset that immigrants are getting attention now, and it's taking attention away from the war, and that reflects the weakness and demoralization of the anti-war movement. We should be very happy that people are in the streets, they're asserting their rights, they're marching, they're raising questions, they're confronting racism, as you pointed out. They're not counterposed. They have to be connected. If you were to go out and poll the people who are marching on those demonstrations about their thoughts about the war, they're against the war overwhelmingly. So it's about how we can make organic connections between these issues. And a number of connections can be drawn. The racism connection that you pointed out, there's certainly a domestic militarization of our society, which has gone hand in hand with the framework of the war on terror and the projection of U.S. power abroad. And that has led to all of these, you know, these absurd and obscene proposals about the militarization of the border, making it a felony to harbor or protect immigrants, all of those kinds of ideas, and really treating immigrants as terrorists. And then a whole connection between these secret procedures for detaining people, deporting people, and so on, that go hand in hand, you know, with the machinations used to target political activists, anti-war activists, and target immigrants, and to deny people their civil liberties. So those connections can be drawn. And then the other thing I think the anti-war movement has to do is assert its independence. The anti-war movement made a big mistake, I think, in its connection to John Kerry in the last election. And we've got to have the integrity of saying this is what we stand for and we're going to fight for it. And we're going to put pressure on both parties, Democrat and Republican. And that's an important element that's been missing. And then finding ways of connecting it, I think, to local issues of concern. In different communities, there's so many ways that we can connect the costs of the war abroad with costs that are being felt at home. and make those connections very organic. And people are doing it in very creative ways. I think some of these initiatives like Proposition I, College Not Combat, which is now trying to pass a similar resolution in Seattle, and also some of these local things that people are doing in their unions and their school boards and their parent-teacher councils and so on, that, you know, all these things can build up from the grassroots to have a national and then ultimately an international impact. Here in the front. So the question is about if Israel might attack Iran, would it be at the behest of the United States, or as it's indicated, might it be on its own initiative, as they've gestured? Well, first of all, certainly there's a lot of saber rattling going on, and Israel is saber rattling, and people know that Israel, although it claims a nuclear ambiguity, official doctrine of nuclear ambiguity, Israel has more than 200 nuclear weapons and is not a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. You know, a contradiction that never seems to arise in the establishment media. The United States can back Israel, which since the 1960s has had hundreds of nuclear weapons, but Iran can't be 10 years away from developing one single bomb. But the reality is, I don't think on a matter of this importance, Israel could act independently of the United States. The relationship of power, despite the idea that the United States wants to encourage sometimes that Israel is this uncontrollable kind of attack dog, we can't rein them in. The reality is that Israel is a client state of the United States, and in matters of that much importance, they're not going to act independently. And we have examples, many examples we can go to, but most recently, Israel attacked Syria, and that was certainly at the behest of the United States. And I really don't see a scenario where they're not going to coordinate their response on this. John, yeah. Your question is a very important one. Imagine a scenario of a possible U.S. attack on Iran. What would the reaction be in Congress, in particular in the Senate? First of all, there's a whole wing of the Democratic Party that's seeking to outflank the Republicans to the right. And Hillary Clinton is one of them, Joe Lieberman, there's others. And so they want to find a cause. And what they want to do is they want to say, Iraq is a distraction. What we really should be doing is going into Iran. What we really should be doing is going into Syria. What we really should be doing... So it's not about a different stance or posture of U.S. empire. It's a tactical debate over how do you dominate and control other countries? How do you best legitimize U.S. power around the world? And that Iraq is not the right battle, or Iraq has to be fought differently. And meanwhile, look at Iran, look at, and so on. And certainly, I think you would see the Congress and the Senate line up behind an attack on Iran. Now, there's an interesting element, which is, you know, if you look at the Seymour Hersh article about Iran, which kind of led to some of the most recent discussion, that was in the New Yorker, where he goes through some of the scenarios about an invasion. There's no way that Seymour Hersh could have gotten the information for that article if there weren't people in the military who were coming to him and saying, Jesus Christ, these people are crazy. I mean, even within the ranks of, you know, top people in the military. And you also, if you look at John Murtha, the Democrat, you know, who's gotten a lot of attention for calling for a redeployment. He didn't call for withdrawal. He used the word, but then really you look at what he's proposing. He's proposing redeployment. And you look at who John Murtha is, he received more money than any other congressman from the space weapons lobby. The guys who want to build satellites that can strike other countries from space, so you don't rely on ground troops, you rely on air power and space power to dominate the world. And the United States, of course, is excels in that area and is preventing any other countries from developing that technology. So it's about pull the troops out, put them in another country in the Middle East, and then, you know, bomb from the skies. So that kind of scenario is emerging as well. But the reality is, I think you would see Congress fall behind it. The real question is, what would public opinion be? And now here you face a contradiction. On Iraq, public opinion has shifted against the war. But now the new latest polls on Iran show people falling for some of the arguments about Iran. So first of all, we have education to do. But second of all, we have to help people generalize that Iraq is not isolated, aberration. It's about what U.S. empire does, and we have to impose the whole project. But that's a generalization that doesn't necessarily come easily, and that's why within the anti-war movement, it's important to shore up the anti-imperialist wing of it that talks about empire, that talks about the history of empire, that challenges the right of the United States to invade any country, not just defines itself to a narrow debate around the tactics of what's a good way to occupy another country. That's a very good question. What might the United States do other than going into Iran in order to try to dig themselves out of the crisis that they've gotten into in Iraq? I think one thing that they're already trying to do is to try to find a way of getting Iraq off the front pages of the newspapers, trying to get it out of the news. Now, all along, they've been trying to censor the images that we see of this war so that, you know, the public won't be aware of the full consequences. We won't see the bodies. We won't see the dead. We won't see the injured. We won't see how graphic and horrible the war and the occupation is. But if they can come up with these ways of making it appear that we're drawing down, we're pulling out some troops, and periodically they've been floating this kind of language, they're hoping that then, you know, the story about Iraq will move to page A8 or, you know, and that people won't pay as much attention. It'll become like Afghanistan. You know, the U.S. is still occupying Afghanistan, but what do we hear about it? Nothing. It's as dangerous to be a U.S. soldier in Afghanistan right now as it is to be in Iraq, you know, but we don't hear about it. So they'll try to make it, you know, an ongoing, horrible crisis, but not one that's kind of creating a public awareness and declining poll ratings for people in positions of power. So I think they'll try to do that. I think there's also, in terms of dangers, though, and these are not things that they necessarily control, but are possible scenarios. I think right now there's a real danger that Israel's going to reinvade the Gaza Strip. You know, they had elections in Palestine, and the wrong people won. You know, they love democracy, except when people vote for, you know, the people they don't like. And so there's a serious kind of brinksmanship going on there. I could see something happening there that would be a deflection away from the crisis in Iraq. The other thing that I think we should consider very seriously is that, as with the Vietnam War, this occupation is going to pass from a Republican administration to a Democratic administration. And then we'll have a whole series of fake resolutions and alternatives, but a continuation of the war and occupation, but with the Democratic administration. Pass the buck. George Bush said recently, it's not up to me to decide when the troops come home. It'll be up to the next president. And the Democrats are not offering any kind of opposition alternative. So as with the Vietnam War, it may be going back and forth. But that buys them more time, because then the Democrats get to come in and have their plan for victory in Iraq, you know, and then the media go along for that ride for a while. So none of these scenarios are pretty, and they're all pretty bad in the absence of us building a much larger movement that can compel them to get the hell out of there.
That was Anthony Arnov, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, speaking last month in Los Angeles. Thanks to Global Voices for Justice for that recording. GlobalVoicesForJustice.org. Thanks also to Skidmark Bob for the live recording of Jim Page in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can download an MP3 or podcast of this and all previous editions of Unwelcome Guests at our website, UnwelcomeGuests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.